How do not only monuments, but also the very idea of monumentality, serve to mystify and perpetuate beliefs that maintain social orders that deserve to be strenuously reevaluated? Archaeologist and anthropologist Dan Hicks traces the development of a particularly virulent strain of monument worship, that which emerges out of what he calls militarist realism, which harnesses technologies of war, particularly colonial white supremacist war, to build institutions, disciplines, museums in its image in order to perpetually maintain a border between those deemed human subjects and the object worlds of the non-human, which includes racial others. Rather than grant the past immunity, Hicks argues that we need to decide for ourselves what we choose to remember and what deserves to be forgotten. Speaking Out of Place is produced in collaboration with The Creative Process and is made with support from Stanford University. I alone am responsible for its content. We hope you enjoy this and other episodes. Please help support Speaking Out of Place by subscribing via our website, speakingoutofplace.com, following us on Instagram, and following me on Blue Sky. You can give me your feedback, suggest people to invite, and topics to cover. Also, please check out my book of the same title, published by Haymarket Books. Kianga Yamata Taylor calls it, quote, the exact book we need for the troubled historical moment through which we are living.
Welcome, and thank you for being on the show. I thought we'd start off with the basics. Could you explain what historical archaeology is?
Yes, of course. So I work in between archaeology and anthropology in this field called either historical archaeology or contemporary archaeology, which sort of sounds often to people like it's a contradiction in terms. But really, it's about where the past and the present meet, where archaeology turns into anthropology, anthropology into archaeology. And at the heart of that is about the relationship in between objects and humans. So how do we write about the past or the present in terms of listening to human voices or evidence from things where maybe human voices have been erased or haven't left as much of a mark on the written record as other people? Wrapped up with that, though, is always the risk of dehumanization, of the sort of treatment of human lives as if the boundary in between a subject and an object is one which is permeable, not in a sort of positive way, but in a more sort of sinister way. And there's a long history of people being treated as things. So really, archaeology and anthropology and that intersection of the disciplines, which of course are 19th century disciplines, are bound up in the history of empire. But really, that's my point of departure. And I talk in the book about the four A's. So I also work not only in archaeology and anthropology, this conversation is also going to range, I'm sure, into art and architecture as well. Yeah. The four A's, I think, have this natural synergy, but at the same time, it's a synergy that has a history.
Yeah. And another word that pops up in the book a lot is fabulation.
Absolutely. Fabulation occurs in the book in part because of the importance of the critical fabulation work of Sadia Hartman, Christina Sharp, and a series of other really important voices that are really moving forward those conversations over silences in the historical record in a very important way in the North American context. Within historical anthropology and archaeology, the work of Michelle Wolfelow, the anthropologist, Haitian anthropologist, in the 1990s wrote a very important book that's called Silencing the Past. He introduced the idea that the past isn't just something that we receive in terms of what survives in terms of evidence, but the gaps in the archive are often sort of silences, which also silencings. They are active silences. He talks about mentions and silences. He says that silencing the past is like silencing a gun. What her and her colleagues are doing in the work of critical fabulation is to encourage writers and readers to fill those gaps with their imagination, to blur the boundary in between fact and fiction where there are these gaps. And so I'm doing something really rather different because I'm working not only with gaps, but in some ways with misrepresentations of the work. And I'm also working from a very different positionality as a white male curator in an elite institution, which is a legacy colonial institution. So the facive in my work is something that worked in a very different way. And really, the point of a departure is that sense that it may be in terms of the stories that monuments tell, in terms of the language of museums, in terms of the rhetoric of the disciplines and ideas in which we're trained, that in some ways we've been lied to, and we need to be careful not to repeat the lies of others.
I think that's one of the first sentences of your book. In fact, how does it feel to be lied to? You have this marvelous passage on page 247. If you wouldn't mind reading that, it's such a marvelous condensation of so much of what you do in the book.
Of course. And so this comes at the end of section 4, which is called No Humans Involved. Let me offer my own future progressive, neither exonerative nor denialist, but something closer to the second law of thermodynamics, a simple statement of entropy, of archaeological taphonomy, the heritage management perspective, if you like. Without preservation, without conservation, without maintenance, every monument will fall. Let them fall then, when they are out of step with the times, when they no longer reflect where a society wants to be going. In the space that opens up, imagine it were possible to try to repair the damage rather than continually reload the weapon.
It's so wonderful the way you replace roads must fall with roads will fall. What's that move all about between must and will?
So it's nice to be asked that relatively early in this conversation, because it's where the hope comes in. When I've talked to people about this book and why the book is called Every Monument Will Fall, this has been the conversation we've had at the end. But let's have it up front and we'll see where that goes. Because what I learned in writing the book, which really tries to triangulate in between objects in museums and the monuments in the street and the ideas in the libraries and the classrooms, and really respond to three movements, and these are long-standing movements which have happened for up to 100 years in some cases, the movement to remove colonialist statues, images of the colonizers, often after independence, movements to return objects in museums, the work of restitution, but also the wider work of the decolonization of knowledge in our libraries and our seminar rooms. So whether in the streets or in the museums or in books and ideas, these are largely indigenous and African-led movements that have this long history. But they all wound up at my door at the Pitt Rivers in certain ways. I mean, they were, in terms of the Roads Must Fall movement, 10 years ago, and of course it's an ongoing movement in Oxford Roads, as an image has not moved. He continues to be there. It continues to stand there. And one of the points I make in the book is we need, and I fell into that myself there, it's easy to find yourself talking about he rather than it. This is an image of a man, not the man himself. So in the form of Rhodes, the colonizer, and the forms of empire that reach as far as Oxford, this is not a conventional model of settler colonialism. Where the hope comes in is that all these movements for removing statues or returning objects or changing reading lists and what we teach have long histories, and they're intergenerational. For example, the Colston statue in the UK in Bristol, which is an 1895 image of a 17th century enslaver. There was a long campaign in the late 90s. I was part of it. I went along to events for the removal of this image of Edward Colston in the late 90s, early 2000s. And there was an attempt then to go through the process in a formal way and to apply to what then was English heritage and to do the work. And at every point, it didn't happen. And so that image remained there until the summer of 2020, when a new generation came along and they simply took it down. So that's a reminder, I think, for all of these issues. Every monument will fall is not called all the monuments must fall. It's rather about the sense that any society, any community, any institution has a right, a democratic right, to reshape or to define its own memory culture. Who we remember, how we remember, who decides who is remembered, rather than having to inherit all of the memories of earlier generations and hold on to every last one, which of course is a nonsense because the world is always changing. So here in the UK, things like listed building consent and alterations to historic buildings have been weaponized in culture war. The idea that things can never change. Whereas, of course, just look out of your window and there's a building being changed or rebuilt. I mean, not least in an ancient sort of city like Oxford as well. But these are issues for us internationally. The Germans have this term, Erinnerungskultur, memory culture. We're seeing in recent years how flawed that idea is. It's often about one kind of memory, only one group of society as being able to define what is remembered and how. But at least there's that conversation going on. And that is a part of how analogies have been made with how to remember empire and so on. So in the UK and in the wider Euro-American sphere, thinking more about memory culture and having that sort of positive sense that there is hope that intergenerational movements, when people really care about who gets remembered or who doesn't, because there's always someone that isn't on the plinth. A lot of people are not on the plinth. One person is. There are also different forms of monument that are not simply an image of a dead white.
Exactly. And you get into so much detail with different examples of that. Just wanted to say two things. When you talk about Oxford and memory and architecture, I told you in 2011, I was there with the Stanford program. We have a building on High Street. And there was this wonky entrance stair that nobody could fix. It was like physically dangerous. But no, that's part of the original architecture. We couldn't possibly. So there was that weird notion there. I wanted to ask you about the idea of militarist realism, which is, again, one of the core elements. Because when you talk about hope, and we will get back to hope. I always end my podcast with hope. We will return to hope. But in the meantime, you show how militarist realism saturates our present consciousness in, through all these objects, even behaviors, tendencies, formations. How do we find this all around us? I think this would be a really good way to give a sense of the flavor of the book, which is massive and persuasive, precisely because you point out the interconnections between a statue of a dead white man and a military insignia or a flak jacket. Could you go into some of those details, perhaps?
Exactly. Or indeed the treatment of the dead, which again is an issue that we can come onto, and ancestors in museums and ancestors in institutions. But yeah, I think the best way of answering that is to go back to those three movements that I mentioned earlier, the restitution movement and the fallism movement and the movement for the decolonization of knowledge. And so each of those movements, it seems to me, or I learned as I sought really to understand them and what they meant for my curatorial practice and the sort of disciplines in which I teach in Oxford, they're responding to impulses and to entities which are within a remarkably narrow temporal range. We know militarist realism. We don't have a word for it. And I made up this name, and others are, I hope, are going to come along and find other names. At one point in the book, I have a playing around sort of section in terms of what we might call this art movement, this intellectual movement. But we recognize it when we see it. It's a looted object in a museum. It's a statue of a general who's sitting on a horse or pointing a gun. Or it's a discipline which is grounded in exist theft of knowledge, theft of art and ways of life and so on. So we recognize it when we see it, but we're not often aware, and we haven't really, I don't think, I found it hard to find any literature that really pointed out that actually it is between, let's say, the 1870s and the 1920s that this sort of peak in these entities emerges. And so militarist realism is realism in the sense of Mark Fisher, the late great Mark Fisher's idea of capitalist realism. His account that the point about late capitalism is it feels impossible to imagine the world otherwise.
Exactly, yeah.
That's what the militarism seems to do. Oh, it's okay to have the military looted objects in museums. Of course, that makes sense. Even though, of course, the reality of that was a co-option of the idea of a museum in the 1870s, 1880s, when the institutions are being formed as ethnological or archaeological museums. It's the same for the image of our memory culture. A part of it comes out in the 1870s after the American Civil War, actually. Yeah. It is the General Lee and other images that are born out of the sense of the lost cause, that idea that this is a war that isn't over. And there are some in the United states who would continue to imagine that the Civil War isn't over. What's interesting about monuments is they are durational art forms. They're not purely representational art forms. They are durational. They're time-based in the same way as the performance art might be. It's actually the same for museums, arguably. And so how has that idea of a war that's unfinished been made to last?
Yeah.
That is what we see in militarist realism as well. And that's really where an archaeological perspective, a contemporary archaeology, historical archaeology comes in. Because in some ways, archaeology is exactly the inverse of history in this case. A historian might imagine themselves back into a point in the past, and they would then proceed, absolutely rightly, to tell the story moving forward, biography of someone's life or what happened to an idea or an institution. For archaeology, we begin with the most recent layer and we dig down. So we're working in somewhere in the middle. We meet the historian, I guess, going the other way. But what that reminds us of is that archaeology works on what survives. Archaeology is the science of human duration. It's about survival, human survival and material traces. So that's a really powerful body of thinking that we can apply then to this art form. We can offer this name, militarist realism, for this sort of proto-fascist way of trying to hardwire forms of cultural supremacism, white supremacism of certain kinds, into ideas and art and museum. Because guess what? Once you've looted an object and it's in a museum, once you've erected a statue and it's outside the courthouse, once you've invented a whole discipline and there are libraries and degree programs in it, it's incredibly hard to change those things because they feel to us like things that should be defended.
Yep.
Or protected. That, again, goes back to the heart of the message of the book, Every Monument Will Fall. We need to hold on to the things that we value as a society. We need to ask who the we is in that sentence. And we need to be aware that, anything that we hold on to is a choice in the present.
Part of the range of the book is that Elon Musk pops up in it too. So here we are in Silicon Valley, and I was thinking about precisely what you mentioned in terms of the Civil War and your discussion, for example, of the Crimean War too, when we find this huge ramp up of technology, which includes machinery of death, but also photography. Could you talk a little bit about that moment? Because that's part of the fascination, too, about preservation, is that we're making such progress. We have these technologies that are our destiny, and we can't turn back against them.
Yes, absolutely. The Crimean War turns into a very important moment in the story of the book and the story of the emergence of archaeology and anthropology as disciplines, but also the idea of preservation, the idea that sort of monuments or archaeological sites ought to be preserved. And I argued that one of the main characters in the book, Augustus Pitt Rivers, the man after whom the museum in which I work is named, a soldier who founded archaeology and anthropology to a large degree in the form in which we now have them internationally, invented what's known as the four-field model of anthropology, which is how it continues to be organized and taught in most parts of the United States. The first in spectra of ancient monuments in the UK, as I say, a very important sort of figure for sort of preservationism. Many of his ideas, I argue, emerge out of that shared moment of new industrial forms of warfare that happen in this colonial, imperial war. The Crimean War, obviously, we would think of the invasion of 2014, Crimea re-emerging as this East-West fault line in between empires originally in the 1850s, the imperial war between the Russian Empire on the one side and then the British and the French and Ottoman empires on the other. Augustus Pitt Rivers was a theorist of how that war was won, and he was very involved himself because he was tasked with the training and, in fact, the adoption in the first place of the rifle as the service weapon of the British Army. And he argued on the one side that it was this small alteration in technology, that sense that there were more rifles on the British and the French side than on the Russian side. The difference between a musket and a rifle, which is a relatively small sort of change in terms of accuracy of bullets, that some material change, so relatively minor, was something that could define whether empires succeeded or fell. On the one side, there's that. There's then also his experience of war and those around him, of the transformation of the living landscapes of the villages and the landscapes of the Crimean Peninsula into archaeological sites, essentially, yeah, within Alps, into just the bodies of the dead, which are being looted for their possessions, and the holes in the ground that are having to be dug in order to bury the bodies. And archaeology is born in many ways, I argue in the book, out of that start of a new industrial phase warfare. So we have to account, I think, for the militarist dimensions of our discipline of archaeology. The way in which we excavate is very much actually linked into the digging of trenches on the front line of wars, but also the militarist sides of anthropology historically as a discipline, and of course, looted objects in museums as well, and the monumental forms of memory that accompany war, and then a part of a wider militarization of society, intellectually, artistically, and culturally. So yeah, that, and as you say, the photographic is part of that. There's a shift, exactly like archaeology. Archaeology and photography share this sense of intervening in terms of the duration of time. In the previous work, I picked a fight with the source of work on photography that we read as interdisciplinary readers, the arguments put by, whether it's Roland Barthes or Susan Zontag or John Berger, for example, who would in the 1970s have associated the idea of the photograph with an archaeological object, a fragment of time that survives, a freeze frame. And if you go back to Zontag, she uses this archaeological metaphor. Whereas for archaeologists, actually, an object isn't a freezing of time. It's a duration. It's an enduring thing that has survived. It's exactly the opposite in some ways. So that archaeological metaphor is interesting because it can be that archaeology and photography have this interrelationship. But in some ways, it has this sense of being about memory and the different forms of technological memory in times of intense mechanical industrial change.
Yes. And one of the lines that you quote from it is he's talking about attacking an archaeological site. It's almost like a military campaign to dig up. And so you mentioned objects. And I have to ask you about the skull cup. When I was at High Table there, all I got was a little silver snuff box from the 18th century. No skull cup involved. So tell us about the skull cup.
Sure, absolutely. So interwoven throughout the story, because the story that we've touched upon so far is one of who gets remembered, about the guy with the name above the door, although, as I pointed out, it's not even his name, it's an inherited name.
Yeah.
Pitt Rivers is all about inherited money from the Caribbean and from other forms of empire, this sort of dead name, this necronym, which he carries on over time, which ends up at the Pitt Rivers, but also the names of other people that we've mentioned already, Cecil Rhodes, Edward Colston. This is a story on the one side about the dead white men that get remembered and how they get remembered. But woven throughout the book is another story. And it was really the inspiration for writing this story. And it is the name of an unnamed, a denamed woman. The story about whom is that she was a Caribbean enslaved person at the early part of the 19th century. We can't tell that story with any absolute certainty, but the circumstantial evidence is there. There's a radiocarbon date that shows that this person died at some point in the final years of the 18th century, and the physical anthropology evidence is that it was a woman. But this is a history where that person's identity has been actively redacted, actively dehumanized, because what happened to their body was that the top of the skull was sawn off and lacquered and waxed and inverted so as to form a sort of vessel, and then was turned into a chalice or cup of some sort, with an addition originally of some silverwork around the rim and then a wooden base that was later replaced with a silver base. On that rim, because this item is at Worcester College, Oxford, on that rim is somebody's name, but it isn't the name of the unnamed, denamed woman whose body this was. It is the name Pitt Rivers. And it's not even the name of the Pitt Rivers who founded the Pitt Rivers Museum in 1884. It's the name of the fascist's grandson, George Pitt Rivers, who was incarcerated in the Second World War as a Mosleyite fascist. He was a eugenicist. He was inheriting the discipline of anthropology from the grandfather whom he idolized, this immensely rich family with a big estate house on the Wiltshire-Dorset border in the south of England, and a second museum which had been built on the estate after the first museum had been handed over to the University of Oxford in 1884. The grandson, when he came out of jail after the end of the war, he returns to his Oxford College. And the first thing he did is hand this item over, this body, this person over, to be used at high table, to be drunk out of, as a wine goblet and passed around. And that was a tradition that continued, not just for 5 or 10 years, but as recently as 2015. And such was the level of use that when the goblet started to leak wine, it was used, she was used, they were used to hold the chocolates over dessert. So it's a sick and shocking story of the use and abuse of a human body, of a woman's body in an all-male environment. Until 1979, Worcester College, like lots of Oxbridge colleges, was all male. But what that story tries to do, what I tried to do from the evidence I had, was to assemble as much as I could to try and tell something about this history of who this person was, and to trace back actually the purchase at Sotheby's in 1884 of this human body part that had been turned into a chalice, and to trace back to this guy called the Armourer, who was a collector of arms and armour in London in the 19th century. And his father, who is maybe the source of the body, was a commander in the Royal Navy in the Caribbean. So I try to piece together as best I can. There are differences in gender. There are differences in identity, in the stories that are told. These are different racialized histories, because, of course, even for Pitt Rivers, this is about the history of cultural whiteness, about how ideas of civilization are associated with certain forms of ethnic or national identity. But fundamentally, I guess, this is a story that I try to get to some sort of resolution in terms of what should happen to this person, and what are the debates there in terms of how we deal with ancestral human remains. How many other examples are there, not of named individuals, where the provenance research can be done and a source community or a descendant community can be found for return, but where the violence was such that there's no name, there's no trace, that it was the erasure of that humanity that was the point. There's a kind of blankness. There's an odd kind of modernism to that emptiness of this item, this body part, which is used in this way in the 1940s and the 1950s and so on. So how to deal with those histories, which is about inheriting over time, literally the inheriting of someone else's body from one generation onto another, but also the inheritance that happens in institutions like Oxford colleges, and indeed my own inheritance as a curator in the Pitt Rivers, the intellectual, the institutional inheritance. How do we learn to be good descendants in this case? And how do we talk about forms of descent, maybe outside of a conventional heteronormative accounts of things that are inherited within families, and think about inheritance across generations and institutions in different ways as well.
Dan, I think you're able also to predict the future, because you got me exactly to the next cluster of questions I had, which is largely about responsibility. And you cite the famous essay by Sylvia Winter, 1994, No Humans Involved. Yeah. And you note that the subtitle is A Letter to My Colleagues. She's obviously talking about academics, but there's a particular Stanford angle into this. Do you know about this summary?
Not in detail, no, please.
Okay, she's writing, about the Rodney King uprising.
Yep.
And I got to Stanford in 1990 from Berkeley, thinking, my God, here I am at the belly of the beast, so to speak. And after the Rodney King uprising, or during it, the liberal wing of the faculty, in the most full-throated way I've ever seen them act. Bought a full-page ad in New York Times, like 200 or 300 of us signed on, protesting the Rodney King verdict. So I think this was in Sylvia's mind as well, saying, listen, boys, you're complicit in inventing and supporting this whole notion of man or human, and get off your high horse and understand how we're all in it. And we talk about man is particularly constructed across various platforms, archaeology, anthropology, museum, university. And I said, and here you are at Pitt Rivers and I'm at Stanford with David Starr Jordan. As you pointed out a while ago, his name was removed and the statue of Agassiz was removed. And the way that the institution tried to finesse it was by saying they didn't condemn Jordan fully. They said he's a complex figure. And they said, after all, he was a pacifist. And as well as I do, he was pacifist because he didn't want the elites to be gunned down by these machine guns. So he went through this elaborate set of operations that led to exploitation of things that later became like the IQ test, saying we can't have the best and brightest of us on the front lines. So that was his very particular way of not being for the war. So can you talk a little bit how you negotiate being in these institutions? And this might also get us into your brilliant discussion of Bruin Latour and the notion of actor network theory and how you make the argument. It's actually riffing off of Edwardian anthropology. So if you could, in any way you want, mesh those things together, or just get into this general area. Yeah.
Absolutely. So where we want to end up at the end of that meshing, although I'm not sure meshing is the right. I mean, it's, you know,
messing maybe.
Yeah, whatever. Exactly. Let's, what we want to end up with is something on the critique of the image of the non-human as it returns in its revenant form in the work of Bruno Latour and others, and the sheer ubiquity of actor network theory, which is now 40 years old. As an idea, it came out of the business schools. It comes from the right. People forget this.
Yep.
It's part of that sort of post-Wende, or around the moment of the fall of the Berlin Wall, a sense that Marxism had failed, that this was a triumph of the right. And that actor network theory, as you've said, I argue, resuscitates one of these leaping figures which we inherit across the disciplines, and actually sells it back to anthropology, come from originally, which is the image of the non-human. But let's start maybe with the work of militarist realism serving to confuse us in two ways. So the militarist realist form, whether it's the statue, whether it's the museum, as you walk around the museum and look at the ethnological, anthropological objects, or whether indeed it's when you pick up a book in any of the four ways, archaeology, architecture, art, and archaeology and anthropology, you are encouraged on the one side to confuse history and memory, that when you're being presented with an image of Agassiz as you walk into Stanford's arguments against the removal of this figure of racial hatred would be, oh, you can't remove history. It's not history, it's memory. It's who should be remembered in that space. Mixing up memory and history, but there's another thing which is also prior to that, which is mixing up the man and the monument, mixing up objects and people. That's how militarist realism works. It's, as we said right at the beginning of the conversation, this is a body of thought and practice, artistic and cultural, that seeks to confuse the category of the human and the non-human by making it seem that some people are less than human or non-human or inhuman, but the inhumanity is at the same time with those who would wish to present themselves as sort of superhuman, as a part of the humanity that comes after other humans. There's a lot in the book about the beginning of ideas over manifest destiny, through which the idea that the levels of violence being exacted with Maxim machine guns on the colonial front lines, a generation after Pitt Rivers had adopted the rifle, there are further military technologies that are going on. And of course, at the heart of that is the idea of the machine gun. How is that justified? This is a civilization that has a technological difference. We're all human, but some people are more human than others because of this thing called culture. So there's a fascinating and I think unwritten, and I make my first attempt really to make a contribution to this important way in which we need to articulate, I think, how what we know and understand as being the fake racial sciences of the earlier parts of the 19th century, Agassiz was a, you know, was a key figure in that, of course, that we saw in our natural history museums, the use of human bodies in all, and natural history displays in order to tell the racist lie that there are different species of human. Those arguments were failing already in the 1860s when a new set of arguments came in that were not about nature, but about culture. So a form of the human, a form of humanity that was about the differences are technological or cultural. And therefore, it's so inevitable that the people with the really big guns are going to be murdering the people with the bows and arrows. That was the Victorian logic. That was the logic of the frontier in the United States. This was the justification of so many forms of white supremacy that we inherit. And I think anthropology and archaeology, and indeed museums, haven't done enough really to talk about that second phase of racism. The key thinker on this, of course, is Frantz Fanon and his essay on sort of culture and racism, cultural racism rather than biological or fake science, which is at the heart of it. So there you end up with an image or a set of arguments over who gets to be counted as human and who doesn't. And here, yeah, Sylvia Winter's work, which is only, I mean, you say is well-known, I think in the UK less well-known, and in the European sort of setting actually less well-known than it is in the United States, and so central and so important for this discipline that invented this guy called Anthropos. Who is this Anthropos character in anthropology? And what, you know, we're now, what, half a century ago that the journal Man renamed it the Journal of the Royal Anthropological Institute. But still, Man is there in some sense. And you pick it up in undergraduate essays, you pick it up in the media when people talk about humans. And of course, importantly, what we learn is that from Winter and others is that it isn't only gendered. It has also racialized the image of man, but also has a history. And Winter makes a distinction between man one and man two. Understanding those histories better is obviously central. All of this narrative, all these absolutely central arguments are completely, in terms of the theory that we read in more theoretical journals and what undergraduates and our postgrads are taught often, is entirely sort of in a vacuum from these arguments over humanity that we see in actor network theory. And we've somehow come in the social sciences and the humanities, it seems to me, to welcome back in this image of the non-human and non-human actors and objects that have agency in these ways, and the permeabilities and the messinesses and the entanglements of objects and humans. Worse than anything, I think, often it's indigenous ways of thinking that are co-opted in order to do this. In some ways, we're seeing a really simply a return of an ideology that Marx absolutely rightly talked about in terms of the, not in language we'd use today necessarily, what his account was in terms of the commodity fetish, the idea, the mystery by which sort of capital appears to be generating itself and money makes itself and all that stuff in Capital. But amazingly today, the pushback whenever anyone says, no, come on, let's think about the category of the non-human or material agency is, yeah, the answer is, come on, there are loads of indigenous communities around the world who think that objects or landscapes or trees or ancestors or whatever are agentive. You can't, of course it's important. Whereas actually that word agentive, this odd social science language, I'm very much inspired on this by the work of the anthropologist Marilyn Trethern, who argued, of course, famously, that agency is only a problem if you have a particular model of structure. The structure agency thing, it's really just practice theory, or gestructuration of the 1970s. It's a body of language that was there to solve a problem, which was structuralism. How do structures change over time? To which there are other answers. And it's interesting how material culture studies became part of a critique of leftist cultural studies in the 1980s and 1990s. And that, interestingly, that field is the one that allowed in this sort of return of the image of the non-human. So actor network theory, hopefully that in this segment gets us back then to where we wanted to be, which is that image of the non-human is not historically unconnected to the long, and I talk about the image of the non-human actually as it appears in early 20th century anthropological texts, and indeed late 19th as well. These arguments over animism, these arguments over materiality have long histories, and we need to be very careful not to simply re-inscribe theoretically ideas that absolutely rightly have been rejected from all other parts of anthropology.
Again, as you point out throughout the book, it's the way of erasing responsibility and creating myths instead as being agents rather than human beings that should be held accountable. And So this sort of gets me into the last part of the interview, because the form of your book is so beautiful. All through the book, I kept on wondering, who is the you? What's going on here? And then I read the acknowledgments. You bring it out there so well, and you say, the book came to adopt a vocative form, addressing a second person, at some points even becoming invocatory, addressing the dead as well as the living, like a spell or a prayer would do. And I'm taken also by the subtitle of your book. You call it A Story of Remembrance and Forgetting, Not a History of. Yep. So there's a really interesting way in which you're carving out this narrative, if you will, space for us to inhabit. Could you talk a little bit about how the form of the book was the most suitable way to tell the story?
Yeah, absolutely. So it turns out that the pronouns are important. We know that already, but the pronouns are important in other ways that I don't think I'd realized until writing the book. Because as I say in the book, number one, to actually not use the pronoun, but to use the names of the dead white men and to repeat them is itself, the risk is you tell the story to try and make the world better or to tell something that should be known that isn't. And you just re-center the colonizer, re-center those names again and again. So there, it starts really, and the thing you're asking about starts from doesn't get named. What happens if when we write a museum label, when we write about a history of a museum or a history of a colonial episode or a history of this violence in all its different forms of racial violence or theft or looting? What if we just don't use the names of these men? And what if we sometimes in quite a convoluted and hopefully occasionally quite funny way, we actually just avoid saying the name to make point? And that was where it started. Let's just push this to the point where it's really obvious, where really all of us, you know, myself writing it more than anyone maybe, have to really think, is it possible to tell the story without continually centering but also therefore not centering myself as well, because this is a story that if I'm not careful, I would do that kind of 90s fix of being reflexive and self-aware of my own, you know, I'd be aware of my of the situated nature of mine, which I would state my positionality and
at
thereby
the very start, yes,
almost underline it and actually make it more of a plot, actually reinforce that positionality. There have to be ways of writing where we can undermine a positionality as well as state it. And therefore, it isn't just the names that are important, it's the first person pronouns. It's the I, it's the we, who counts as the we. It's talking about our heritage, our field, who's a part of that our, who isn't, how do we think about that? Out of that, the second person emerged. In part, the book was written in a period of loss, and I wove the loss of a colleague and some of the family loss, which I had, into, I hope, a way of writing which was more appropriate for writing about the death and abuse of a woman's body after death, and to find the tone and to find the vocabulary and to see this as the work of mourning and the work of coming to terms with histories which are not going to be told as histories, because they're not history, they're not even history, they're, as the famous line goes, they're in the present, but they're not finished. And so the vocative or the invocative, invoking the dead, the voice of a prayer, actually came across. And someone said to me a couple of weeks ago that when they got to the end of the book, and this was absolutely a dream for me because it was what I hoped the feeling might be for some people, was that the second person, you, actually also managed to reach out and to be the reader as well. It's a dialogue with the reader as well, because the point is, we have, when we're writing about these histories of memory and of, you know, dehumanization and so on, we have to find ways of rebuilding communities and having voices that are more than just the expertise that comes from the curator, but other forms of expertise that are part of the of these dialogues as well. So yeah, the dialogical, and of course, in the background, there is a tradition of storytelling in historical archaeology. We've mentioned the importance of the critical fabulation work. There's a bunch of other writers in there, which is fairly eclectic, from the Maggie Nelson inspiration, and she works in between fact and fiction in such wonderful ways, from the Ursula Le Guin arguments over forms of narrative, although I also have my own take a little bit on whether we should trust the carrier bag theory or not. And then so many of the other writers that we've mentioned already, from Winter to Trullow to Stuart Hall, who we haven't mentioned yet, but in terms of cultural studies was so important. Actually, the work of the artist Isaac Julian, with whom I worked and I helped to make his last film while I was writing this book, in the early phases of writing it. And actually, Isaac's work, as I say in the book, and I write about Isaac Julian's practice, I got to know a lot about his practice out of that collaboration and the way in which he tells a story. He has a certain approach to narrative and to truth-telling and to history and memory, which was wonderfully inspiring. So Isaac's in the mix as well. Yeah,
this is where I derive the hope that the monuments will fall indeed because of this kind of community that you create and give us a sense of. My last question is, I had Françoise Vergès on, and when she talked about the idea of a museum without objects, do you have any thoughts on that? She basically said, we don't want to reclaim anything. We want to derive other ways of having museums, because museums themselves always will gravitate toward reinstantiating their founding logic. Any thoughts about that? And she's using this, I think it's from Fanon, case, a state of extreme disorder.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's a wonderful, I'm so excited to hear that you had her on. I will go and listen back to her interview. And absolutely, she's one of the key thinkers about museums. And of course, you're thinking from outside museums, and I'm having to think from within the museum. That's my job. I've been a curator of the Pitt Rivers now for 18 years, one of the most iconic and infamous museums in terms of the relationship between enduring colonialism, legacy colonialism. I'd say for me, the concerns are that there are some institutions that will embrace the language of decolonialism, will embrace the performative Macron memory mix of high-profile returns, and then think that somehow they can get rid of all the difficult stuff and then they can carry on.
Exactly.
The future. This has to be about much more than that. The whole reason to tell the history of the use and abuse of the woman's skull at the Oxford dining table is to say, if that can survive for 70 years without anyone being able to end it, what else is surviving, which is less visible, that is an open secret, but actually no one really knows about this? How is it that that story was never told? What should happen to the body now? What should the college do? We don't have adequate answers. Number one, if we want to talk about museums without objects, how about museums without ancestors? Human beings are in our museums now, around the world, in North America, in Europe. We've just, in the UK, I've been part of a policy brief from the all-party parliamentary group on reparations and restitution. And we published a policy brief in March this year, 2025, about laying the ancestors to rest. There, we point out, number one, it remains in the UK entirely legal to buy and sell human remains at auction. So Augustus Pitt Rivers, if he was alive today, would have gone to Sotheby's and bought that person's skull now. And in the long history of Cutty in our museum, in society, it may well be that the museums were not an aberration. You could tell the story of carcerality from enslavement via abolition into museums, and so not the bodies of the living, but then the bodies of the dead. And then 100 years later, in the post-war period, mass incarceration. And you could really easily tell that history. So actually, the taking of bodies and the piling of them up in museums within that 100-year period from the middle of the 19th century into the middle of the 20th century is not an aberration. It was part of longer-term history. And where we could estimate that maybe there were 500,000 individuals. That's possible. We don't know. It's incredible that we don't know. How can we not know? How near are your listeners right this moment from somebody's ancestor in a cardboard box wrapped up in acid-free tissue, not even on a database, or sitting under somebody's desk. We read and rejoice when we hear about restitutions under NAGPRA in North America for Native American ancestors, internationally for other ancestors, but we still don't have the basic inventories for right. So many institutions, and that includes the North American institutions as well. It includes the United States as well. What happens, number one, when are we going to see transparency in the publication of the databases? When the databases aren't there, when are they going to be made? Should we license the holding of human remains in the first place? If these are medical, in the UK, if you have human remains that died after 1948, then there has to be consent. And if there isn't consent, then there is burial or there is other dignity is found in some form of disposal or some either cremation or burial. Where's the consent for these earlier histories of people? These are human beings. There is no possible reason for legacy 19th century human remains to be held onto in our museums. All these arguments over the science might get better, we might improve the DNA work. These are just the new racial sciences. And the time's up in terms of using racialized bodies for science. This is unacceptable. So that's the first bit. And the second half of that would be for objects, absolutely transparency about what's in the museums. For American listeners, I think remembering that restitution is not only a national issue, it's an international one. There's been some really great work on the Benin bronzes. In my last book, in the British Museums, a part of that was simply by writing my best attempt of a list of where I think the Benin bronzes are, because it turns out they're not all in the British Museum. And that led to the Fowler Museum. It led the Smithsonian and other institutions across America to begin to, with obviously not because of me, because of the long-term movement since the 1930s, for the movement to be made in terms of returns. So important that we see that transparency. And that's part of the work of the curator in the present. I think we'd never needed something like World Culture Museums more than we'd present. And here I depart a little bit from the arguments of some colleagues and some dear colleagues. Because we need spaces in which there are forms of art, forms of making and design and knowing and seeing, believing, which are outside of a Eurocentric lens, American lens. But that doesn't mean that when somebody somewhere is asking for something back, or there are ancestors in the collections, or actually these are just looted objects on display, that things need to remain the same. So I don't think it's reform. Exactly. I totally understand and have a good deal of sympathy with the burn it all down and start again school of thought. I talked in the British Museums about the dismantling of white infrastructure, and I think that's an important part of this. But yeah, there is hope. There's hope more than anything, because anyone listening that has been part of a campaign to return an object or to remove a monument, to change a memory culture, normally it takes 30, 40, 50 years, actually. Wow. Every time Cecil Rhodes has fallen, and he's fallen in Zimbabwe, he's fallen in Zambia, he's fallen in Cape Town, he fell in Oxford. The night, there was a colleague of mine told me, his younger brother in 1998, was at school, at the Cheney School, secondary school, high school in Oxford. And as an 18-year-old, he just got a room, was called the Cecil Rhodes Room, and they renamed it the Nelson Mandela Room. And that's another one of those examples. But these things runs across the generations. Yep. They wrote themselves in, these guys, into our cultural fabric so much. There's a lot of work to unpick it, but it's all worth doing.
No, exactly the case, because it just, the resistance and the alibis just morph. And I was thinking that the case in San Jose State where an anthropologist refused to return some indigenous bodies. And she said, you're just all about cancel culture. So just sort of slaps that on top of it. But it's, as you point out in your book so brilliantly, it's not just objects, it's mentalities. It's the mentalities that the objects keep alive. And we keep thinking along those terms. And I love the way that you say it's a kind of prayer. And I'm with you on that journey. And thank you so much for being on the show, Dan. I know you're exhausted. You have another podcast in half an hour or so. So I really appreciate your generosity.
It's absolutely great to be here. And it's been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much. It's a joy and a privilege to be read. So thoughtfully. And to be talking, this is a conversation we learn from each other. The book ends just up the road from you. When I was there last year, just a couple of days after the Trump election. And in these times when it turns out you're not just having to suffer the cancellation of all those grants from the National Endowment of Humanities, you're having to see the investment of that money in statues in a garden. So these issues over monuments, these issues over what the aesthetic that goes with the new inherited and morphing forms of fascism that we're dealing with, these are not going away. These are urgent. So my small attempt helping thinking about that, although it's a big book, is to help think, you know, fundamentally how it isn't only what we're inheriting, it's how these structures are evolving and changing and shape-shifting from Augustus Pitt Rivers FRS to Elon Musk FRS.
Right.
And or as one might say, Elon Musk FRS,
yeah,
Musk FRS, FFS.
Like, no, and again, the fact that they will fall it's incumbent upon us to claim the present from the past.
Exactly.
So thank you very much, Dan. Talk to you later.
Yeah, bye. Cheers. Thanks again.
Bye.